From New Jersey to Florida, Virginia to Hawaii, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Tax Cuts 2.0 are making progress in the U.S. House of Representatives. Adam Michel of the Heritage Foundation is here to talk about key elements of the bill. October 1st is the deadline for a new federal budget. That, of course, won't happen, but a continuing resolution appears headed for a presidential signature. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story. Trade policy has been making headlines as the president renegotiates key treaties. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks strategy with Steve Forbes. And the future financial stability of Social Security is a concern. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, has an American Radio Journal commentary on what can be done to ensure its viability. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which went into effect at the beginning of this year, has supercharged the U.S. economy. But more work needs to be done to lock in those gains. Adam Michel is a policy analyst at the Rowe Institute for Economic Policy at the Heritage Foundation. He is here to explain what components should be included in Tax Cuts 2.0. Adam, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Adam, as we look at the possibility of some additional movement on tax cuts, let's just take a minute or two and go back and look at the 2017 tax reform bill, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. How has that worked out for American business, for American workers, for American families?
The last round of tax reform that was passed in 2017 has been tremendous for sort of all of those segments you just mentioned. There's sort of two components that I like to highlight. One is the actual tax cut, and we use some IRS data, and we've actually found that taxpayers in every single congressional district across the country will receive thousands of dollars back on their taxes this year, and many people are already seeing that through lower withholding in their bimonthly paychecks. But the second piece is the economic growth that comes from tax reform. The businesses are adding new jobs for the first time in history. There's more jobs available than people looking for them. Small business optimism is at all-time highs. We're seeing wage growth outpace levels that we haven't seen since 2009. Manufacturing is at a 14-year high. You sort of go down the list, and all the indicators are pointing in a good direction.
And so as we look at the fact that the Congress is now considering what we're referring to as Tax Cuts 2.0, there are some major ways, and you talk about them in a recent piece that you wrote for the Heritage Foundation. We're going to talk about each of those three areas. So let's start out. We do have individual and small business tax cuts, but there's an expiration date for that, is there not?
Yeah, unfortunately, Congress wasn't able to make all of the tax cuts permanent. Many of the individual provisions, the lower rates, the larger standard deduction, the doubled child tax credit, expire after 2025. And although that seems like it's a long way off, it'll be here before you know it. And so Congress, the House, is working right now. Later this week, they'll be voting on it to make all of those things permanent so that your taxes don't automatically go up in the future, protecting all of that good news that we were just talking about.
And as we look at this, one area that has been particularly controversial is what's called SALT, the state and local deduction. This is where you get to deduct your state and local taxes from your income taxes. A cap was put on that. Some of the larger states that are high tax states are unhappy with this. Is the SALT cap likely to stay, or is that something that may be eliminated or diminished?
The SALT cap, $10,000 cap on the federal deductibility of your state and local taxes, is going to stay. It's in the bill that they're voting on this week, and that's a good thing. Before the tax cuts went into effect, the federal government was actually providing a subsidy to the Californias and the New Yorks and the New Jerseys of the world so that their local state and local taxes were actually higher than they otherwise would be. And so what this does is it puts pressure on state and local governments to really take a look at what they're spending their money on and how high their taxes are, and we're seeing this across the board. There's states across the country that are reassessing their state tax systems, lowering taxes in tandem with the federal reforms. That's what folks that are in some of these high tax states should be demanding of their local legislators. Certainly not a federal tax problem. It's really coming from the fact that state and local taxes are so out of whack in many of these states.
Another area that you have taken a look at and where there is room for further reform is when it comes to family savings. And you talk about some strategies for simplifying and expanding the ability of families to save. So tell us a bit about that.
This is one of the things that I'm really excited about in this reform package and tax reform 2.0, and hope to see more done in the future. The first is, if you think about your retirement savings accounts, your 401k, your IRA, these are accounts that you can put money into for retirement, and then it will grow in the stock market, and that growth is ultimately tax-free. So it's not penalizing you for investing your money, for saving it for the long term. And so, unfortunately, a lot of these retirement systems are incredibly complicated, and it's hard for small businesses to access them or to set up programs that allow their employees to access. And so the Tax Reform 2.0 simplifies some of those rules, which is a big step in the right direction, but I think more importantly creates what's called a universal savings account. And this is something that is very similar to that retirement account I just described. However, you can use it for whatever you would like. You can use it for the next time your refrigerator breaks down, you need to replace it, or for your child's education, for a family vacation that you're planning several years down the road. Getting that foot in the door, getting one of these established is really important, and I hope that we, as we move into Tax Reform 3.0 and beyond, the size of these accounts can be further expanded.
And another component is the American Innovation Act of 2018, and this, Adam, to encourage business innovation. Tell us how those strategies would work.
Biggest piece of this bill is allowing new businesses, entrepreneurs, to write off their startup costs immediately. Right now, if I'm an entrepreneur and I'm starting a business, I can't actually deduct my startup costs, or I only can deduct $5,000 of my startup costs right away. I have to write off over the next, I think, 15 years often, the rest of those costs. And what that does is it makes it harder for entrepreneurs to start new businesses, for small businesses to get off the ground. So what the bill does is just raise that threshold, say, hey, you can write off a larger portion of those startup costs, making it easier for small businesses to get off the ground. And I think this is one of the places where there is room for improvement to these bills. What they leave out is giving this ability to write off new investments immediately to all businesses. It's not something that should be just for entrepreneurs or just for small businesses. It's called expensing in the sort of tax jargon here in Washington, but all it means is businesses should be able to deduct costs when they make them rather than having to depreciate them over a long period of time.
We have been talking with Adam Michel, who is a policy analyst with the Roe Institute for Economic Policy, that at the Heritage Foundation, of course, in Washington, D.C. Tell us a little bit about Heritage, Adam, and also where can folks go to read more about this and other topics?
Here at Heritage, we cover just about every issue. We're advocating for more limited, more streamlined government, and you can go to heritage.org.
Adam Michel of the Heritage Foundation. Adam, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
Andy Roth is at the offices of the Club for Growth, where, of course, he's been keeping an eye on a very busy congressional session. Congress did not take much of a break this year. Of course, the calendar recently been dominated by the Kavanaugh confirmation to the Supreme Court of the United States. That, of course, ongoing. But, Andy, first of all, good to have you here. A lot of items remain on the agenda for the waning weeks of this congressional session. Tell us what still has to be done.
You're right. The Congress did not take much of a break this year. We shouldn't feel that sorry for them, though, because they're not being productive and following the will of voters. But typically, they do take a vacation in August for the entire month. The House pretty much did do that, but Mitch McConnell decided that the Senate should stay in session to deal with Kavanaugh and a few other issues that were pressing. But September 30th is the deadline for the fiscal year, so the biggest thing that Congress had to work on is the budget. And of course, as you know, and as your listeners may know, they haven't passed a budget in years. I've lost track, but I think it's in the double digits now. So instead, what they do is they pass a continuing resolution, or a CR, which basically just keeps the government running at current levels. Every couple of years or so, they'll crack a deal, a bipartisan deal, where they plus up the spending on all sorts of stuff because they can't agree to an overall budget, but they can agree to spending levels. And that's what happened this year. They were able to pass some spending bills to fund, like, the Labor Department and HHS and Defense and a few others, but they couldn't complete the spending bills on the other agencies. So they just passed a CR through December 7th of this year, which, as you know, would be a lame duck session because we have the elections in November. So nothing good happens in lame duck sessions, but they're setting this up to have to deal with it in December. My guess is that if the Republicans lose the House and maybe the Senate, then the Democrats will want to make all of the decisions regarding the budget. So in December, they'll just pass another CR to get into next year, and then that's when they'll start getting crafty with their budget decisions and just try to force a showdown with Trump. Some other things on the agenda for Congress ahead of the elections is a farm bill. They're not getting anywhere on that. The House passed a bill. The Senate passed a bill. So they're currently in conference. But I don't know that they can come to an agreement and pass something before the elections. But this is a good thing because the bills that they have passed have not been good. They have had little to no reform in them. So the best thing they can do there is to just extend the current farm bill for a year, and hopefully conservatives can take another crack at it next year. And then you've got all sorts of other ticky-tack things that we can talk about. Trade is obviously another big one, and then you've got FAA reauthorization and all sorts of other things.
Let's talk a little bit more about the budget, Andy. The president, of course, the last time one of these massive continuing resolutions was passed, said he would never do it again. And he threatened a government shutdown if he didn't get funding for his border wall. Is it likely that that funding is going to be forthcoming in the current round of resolutions?
No. And I think that Trump is either being pragmatic or he's distracted with the Kavanaugh circus or with other things, but he has said that he's going to sign this. So he won't get his border wall funding. He won't get a lot of his priorities. In fact, I don't think he'll get any of them, maybe a couple. And worst of all is that Democrats and Republicans in Congress could not agree on what to spend money on. So they just decided to spend money on everything, on the Democrat priorities and Republican priorities. So this budget comes in over budget. It comes in over what Trump requested. And this is the sort of bill that Trump should have vetoed. But because of all the other circumstances that are going on in Congress, he chose not to.
Andy, another big item is Tax Cuts 2.0. Of course, we talked with Adam Michel a few minutes ago. He's talked with us about what is contained or should be contained in the next bill. But let's talk now about practically what might happen. Where do Tax Cuts 2.0 stand in the legislative process?
Well, first of all, let's just state right up front that this is a very good idea. Congress is full of bad ideas, and they're fulfilling their, well, they're not fulfilling a promise, but they're making good on doing a lot of bad things. But this is one bright spot in the overall agenda. The House is going to fulfill that promise. They're going to push the tax cut across the floor, but then it's dead on arrival in the Senate, which I think is unfortunate. You know, maybe there's not enough time to take care of it ahead of the elections, but I think it's very important for Democrats, both in the House and the Senate, to go on record as to where they stand on making individual tax cuts permanent, and making small business tax cuts permanent, and making sure that we can create more savings opportunities so that people aren't going to be squandered in debt for their whole life. I think all of this stuff makes sense. I think it's great that Speaker Ryan and Ways and Means Chairman Kevin Brady have decided to do this. Just wish that the Senate would take it up before the election and force these Senate Democrats to take a position.
That would be a good thing to have happen. One other bit of legislation, one other area that we have been following is there was a lot of talk about a new transportation bill, the president wanting to upgrade the nation's infrastructure. Is that moving along or has it sort of fallen off the agenda?
Completely fallen off the agenda. Now, that might change next year, but there's so many other things going on right now.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, as always, we like to end our discussions having you tell us a little bit about the club.
You bet. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 people from all across the country, from all walks of life, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you again for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Tariffs, renegotiation of free trade agreements, all major developments that affect U.S. trade relations with other countries. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine recently sat down with Steve Forbes to get his thoughts on these issues. Eric?
We've just seen the largest escalation of the trade war between the United States and China, with President Donald Trump announcing last week that there would be new tariffs placed on about $200 billion worth of Chinese imports. But are tariffs really the right way to bring China to the table and to get some of the concessions that the Trump administration is rightfully seeking? Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. We are honored today to be joined by Steve Forbes. He is the editor-in-chief and the chairman of Forbes Media, and he knows a thing or two about trade and about running a successful business. Steve, thanks so much for taking some time and being here with us on the show.
Good to be with you, Eric. Thank you.
Now, Steve, you've been following the trade war. You obviously follow current events quite closely. This has been going on now for the better part of a year. We've had this sort of escalating tension on international trade. We've got the biggest escalation of the trade war, of conflict between the U.S. and China just here in the past few weeks. What do you make in broad strokes of the Trump administration's trade policies so far?
Well, right now we're still having serious skirmishes. It's not yet a trade war on the scale that we had devastatingly in the 1930s. And I think there is some optimism that we're going to get something done on NAFTA, that we'll get some productive negotiations going with the EU on reducing or getting rid of all tariffs and trade barriers on a number of industries. There's been talk in the past, and I hope we pursue it, about pursuing a free trade agreement with the UK as well as the EU. I think that would be good for both. The big stickling point is, you mentioned, is China. And there, I think that we have to make a distinction between trade and trade abuses. Trade abuses is when you violate the rules that you agreed to. China went to the World Trade Organization, the Free Trade Organization, or Freer Trade Organization, and its predecessors have been in existence since the late 1940s with the goal of reducing barriers. Tariff and non-tariff barriers. And China has not been behaving, obeying those rules. China also has been credibly accused of forcing companies to give up their know-how, their technology. Many companies, not for national security reasons, but just for mercantilist reasons, protectionist reasons, have been barred full entry into the Chinese market, forced mergers with domestic partners. Those are trade abuses. And in terms of other trade, if we want to sit down and negotiate lower barriers, I'm all for it. But we have to remember, tariff is another word for tax. And to impose taxes on American consumers and American businesses, I'm not sure is the most effective weapon. And yes, China will be hurt more than we will be hurt. But make no mistake, Eric, we will be hurt.
You're listening to American Radio Journal, and we are talking to Steve Forbes. He is the editor-in-chief and chairman of Forbes Media, and he has been something of a critic, a conservative critic, of President Donald Trump's trade policies over the last few months. Steve, you were just saying that tariffs are not, you know, in your mind, they're not an effective way to get China to stop abusing these trade rules because, you know, ultimately tariffs are just taxes, and it's really Americans that are paying for these things. So sort of a two-part question here. The first part is, what What do you think the White House is missing? What is it that they're not seeing as they pursue this route? Because obviously the president thinks this is the way to go.
There's a lot of misunderstanding about deficits. For example, I'll give you a shocking piece of news. Forbes magazine has had a trade deficit with its paper suppliers for 101 years. I'm outraged that they don't buy in subscriptions and advertising nearly enough to undo our trade deficit with them. But when you go to work, you have a trade surplus with your employer. When you go to a restaurant, you have a trade deficit. The key thing to keep in mind is that countries don't trade with each other. It's individuals and organizations that trade with one another. And they do it because each gets something out of the transaction. That's what Adam Smith taught us 240 years ago. And it's still valid today. And this is where I think Kudlow and others are pushing, is the president said, let's get rid of all barriers. Well, yes, let's do that.
So then that brings me to the second part of the question, Stephen. The second part would be, what do you see as the better thing to do here, if not tariffs, if tariffs aren't going to work, and if trade is important, which it certainly is, what is the right way to go about getting China to come to the table and to stop doing some of these things that the president is concerned about? And it sounds like you share those concerns, too.
In the case of the Chinese, I think if we had united with our allies, with Canada, with Europe, who all face the same abuses that we've faced, and gone to Beijing and said, these are not tolerable. We'll take it to the WTO. And if the WTO is unable to deal in terms of arbitration with all the ways you can try to finagle the rules today, then rewrite the rules. That's why we have the WTO from the old GATT, the General Agreement of Tariffs and Trade. So you modernize, but you also say there are specific industries or specific companies or specific banks that are doing things that shouldn't be done, and we'll go laser-like against them. So that way you don't harm your consumers, you don't harm your businesses with retaliatory taxes. You focus on specific areas. And I think certainly behind the scenes, that kind of united front or publicly, you would have seen more results more quickly than what we're going through now.
Yeah, if there's a chance to get China to make some of these concessions, the concessions that the president is seeking, the concessions that I think are important to the ongoing relationship between the United States and China on trade, maybe there's a better way to go about it, because the tariffs, look, we're all going to end up paying for that, and it may not even accomplish the goals that the president thinks they will. That is, unfortunately, all the time we have for today, though. That's Steve Forbes. He's the editor-in-chief and the chairman of Forbes Media. And, Steve, thanks so much for taking some time out of your busy schedule and stopping by here to chat with us today.
Good to be here, Eric. Thank you.
And again, check out everything at Forbes, at Forbes.com. They've got fantastic coverage of politics and business and just about anything else you'd want to read up there at Forbes.com. And check us out as well at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. We'll catch you right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The Social Security system, upon which millions of Americans depend to help finance their retirement, is headed for financial problems. On this American Radio Journal commentary, Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, outlined some steps that can be taken to stabilize the system.
Reports of labor shortages, particularly in the trades and other high-skilled professions, are almost daily occurrences. Virtually every employer that I speak with laments the shortfall. In addition, many business executives are extraordinarily concerned about the pending retirement of so many baby boomers, which will further exacerbate the labor shortage. With the retirement of so many workers, the financial condition of Social Security is at the forefront of many seniors' and legislators' minds as well. Senior citizens are increasingly concerned about whether they will have sufficient financial resources in retirement to live comfortably in light of skyrocketing costs for long-term care and end-of-life medical costs. In terms of the labor shortage, it has recently become clear that there are more jobs available than there are people to fill them, even though the labor force participation rate is still relatively low. It is also interesting to note that the participation rate for citizens age 55 and older is increasing very rapidly since the 2008 financial meltdown, partly to help rebuild financial assets lost during the recession. When considering when to retire, one of the major concerns relative to citizens is the impact that their decision has on their retirement planning. Under current federal law, individuals who retire at age 62 and start drawing Social Security majority see a reduction in benefits due to the early retirement. The following is a statement for a summary for those age 62 or above until they reach full Social Security retirement age, and I quote, "You claim benefits before your full retirement age. Your benefits are reduced a fraction of a percent for each month before your full retirement age. If you also continue to work, your benefits will reduce if you earn more than the yearly earnings limit. If you fall under full retirement age for the entire year, we deduct $1 from your benefit payments for every $2 you earn above the annual limit. For 2018, that limit is $17,040. In the year you reach full retirement age, we deduct $1 benefits for every $3 you earn above a different limit. In 2018, the limit on your earnings is $45,360, but we only count earnings before the month you reach full retirement age." End of quote. The significance of this is that your benefit is reduced since you were taking it earlier than at full retirement age. And additionally, the benefit is in fact taxable, and there's a repayment of your Social Security benefit based upon earnings in excess of $17,040. It's called the clawback provision. This is punitive at best from a retirement perspective. Perhaps it's time to rethink Social Security policies. Reducing the benefit because of drawing it early at age 62 is strictly an actuarial calculation, and it makes sense. The reduction relates to the present value implications of taking Social Security at age 62, for example, versus at full retirement age. In light of the dire financial condition of Social Security, as well as the nation's significant labor shortage, it would be prudent to eliminate the clawback provision for Social Security for someone working between the ages of 62 and 66. Additionally, once a taxpayer reaches full Social Security retirement age, it would make sense to permit cessation of individual Social Security contributions up to age 70 and eliminate individual Social Security contributions after age 70. The employer portion, of course, would still be paid, as well as would be the Medicare tax, regardless of age, by both the employer and the employee. These measures would be designed to allow workers to remain part-time in the workforce beyond a certain age, providing some relief to the labor shortage of qualified persons, while at the same time providing additional funds to seniors whose long-term care costs have exploded, have become incredibly unpredictable. When the Social Security measures for early retirement clawback were first introduced, the life expectancy in our nation was significantly lower, and long-term care costs were reasonable to accumulate in a lifetime for many workers, although not all. A growing number of seniors are concerned about running out of money in retirement. Once a person retires, the ability to re-enter the workforce declines. Concurrently, the longer one is in retirement, the more perishable the skills for the position that they left during their careers. Reforming Social Security at the early retirement age of 62 and beyond to make it more attractive to work part-time reduces pressures on seniors for financial planning, lessens impact on their children who are now also potentially caregivers, provides for qualified, capable workforce in a period of a shortfall of workers, helps to replenish Social Security, and reduces the drain on Medicaid should a senior run out of money before they die. One of the greatest opportunities to restore stability to our workforce and to prevent significant pressures on families in caring for the increasing number of seniors involves relatively minor changes to Social Security, but a major change in mindset about how qualified seniors can continue to help an economy and society extremely short of qualified workers. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include WKCT-AM in Bowling Green, Kentucky, WBUV-FM in Biloxi, Mississippi, along with KUKI-FM in Ukiah, California. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.